So let's do some Ask 9to5 Mac to round out this kind of holiday episode.
The year. Round out the year.
Jake asks, what are your thoughts on government bodies changing the way tech companies work and make their products? Is there an overall for or against, or is it more complicated than that? What do you think about this one, Mayo?
Well, it depends on the situation, right?
There's like, a lot of nuance, yeah.
There's a lot of nuance because sometimes government bodies make good decisions and sometimes they make less good decisions. I think a classic example of the, even if it wasn't like a going against the legal system, it was like a miss outcome, was the Apple Books case all those years ago against Amazon with agency pricing. Yeah. And, you know, Apple ended up getting raked over the coals for that. They got screwed. And it basically just helped Amazon keep a monopoly over ebook market. Like, I don't think there were, the you know, you get into the nitty gritty of the legal arguments and it, you know, it was fine as far as the law is written. But you can see the outcome as probably not being productive for everybody. And so Apple basically had to backtrack on books and they've had no foothold in the ebooks market ever since. You can't really argue that was a better outcome than, you know, the more competitive situation that Apple tried to start back with the iPad in 2010. So that's an example where it went wrong. I think stuff like the App Store, the more recent stuff, comes from a good place and probably does need reining in, because if you just let Apple carry on, they'll dominate the entire world. With no clear way, no clear outlet for other competition to seep into the market. So it is definitely comes down to a case-by-case situation. I mean, you can even look at the Massimo ITC case right now. Like, that's the government telling Apple that they got to stop selling their products because it's, you know, a government-controlled body with the rules, implementing the rules of law. And you can argue that the patent system is stupid and therefore anything relating to patents shouldn't be allowed to happen. So that's bad. But, like, overall, I think generally you have to agree that the law works. And so governments, you know, in their privileged position, do get to control what companies do. And generally, the outcomes are fair. Mm-hmm. But obviously, some of these things are just subjective. Some of these things are just disconnected from reality and the results are bad. Like, I think getting Apple to change its behavior around the App Store is probably good. But there's many different avenues or enforcements that you could force them to do. Some of them I think are silly and some of them I think are fine. So it does depend. And with Apple, like, attention from government is naturally tied to the success of the company, right? Because when companies are small, they don't have the market power to really attract attention and regulation. Apple is huge. You know, unbelievably huge. Like, 10 times the size it was 10 years ago. And naturally, they attract now 10 times the interest from governments. So they take the rust with the smooth. They have armies of lawyers that can fight everything. You know, they know their position in the market. They could have made changes around the App Store years ago. You know, I'm sure all of these outcomes were talked about and discussed and predicted. They haven't been blindsided by it. So, you know, you can't give them too much pity. But sometimes a government makes a good decision. Sometimes they make silly decisions. So yeah, there is nuance here.
I think there are a lot of examples too where just the threat or Apple knowing that governments are watching them has led to changes sort of preemptively. A good example is the App Store Small Business Program, where they cut the App Store rate for developers making under $1 million from 30% to 15%. That helps them quite a bit in their argument that 30% commission rates are just too high. You can also sort of see the same thing in the EU with the Apple Pay case that we just talked about. But on the flip side, there's changes like the USB-C switch on the iPhone 15 that right now, that's a great change, and it probably only happened because of the pressure in the EU and the common charger regulations. But one thing I worry about is that in 5, 6, 10 years, whenever something better than USB-C is here, are we going to have to wait for the EU to change and update those rules before Apple can make a switch? And will having those rules in place kind of disincentivize companies like Apple from making something new? There's the benefit now, and then there's also ramifications down the line. Because these government agencies move slow.
Decisions that are forced upon you 5 years ago suddenly look silly 5 years later in some cases. So you know, you have to keep with the times. And unfortunately, governments are not as responsive as capitalistic companies at wanting to make changes, right? So it's a big, big elephantine mess. And, you know, the law is understandable by most people, because it is like built on hundreds of years of changes, and there are edge cases and places where technology have just outstripped the law by a mile, and so we, you know, they end up catching up and being too slow. I think you could argue that action on the App Store is coming too late. Like, it probably should have happened 5 or 10 years ago, right? Like, there's so the government doesn't act perfectly, companies don't act perfectly, the existence of both. You know, they generally, the tensions even out and they keep each other in line. Like, the most recent stuff that I think is a bit of a stupid is, like, the stuff around iMessage. Like, I really don't think iMessage is a thing that the government should be, like, cracking down on, like, the Apple's position on it. Because I think the competitive market for messaging is pretty strong. Like, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Telegram, Signal, all these applications, they can live and thrive under the iPhone as it is today in the App Store. And WhatsApp's bigger than iMessage in most countries. So, like, you can't just say that Apple's monopolizing on the system. And it's not like, those messaging apps mostly monetize through, like, advertising, right? And so the economic argument about, like, in-app purchase doesn't really apply, or it applies far less. So if Apple's, like, the EU thing at the moment with the DMA about forcing interoperability in messaging is, like, a bad situation, and that applies to iMessage, but it also applies to WhatsApp, right? Like, WhatsApp's going to be under those same rules next year. I kind of think that's stupid too. Like, I think, what's the point of having messaging apps? What's the point of companies existing to offer unique messaging experiences if they all just have to, like, interoperate with each other? So maybe other people disagree, but that's kind of my position on something most recently that I think's silly. But overall, you know, I'm not an anarchist. I think governments make sense.
I also always like to point out that the United States has done almost nothing in this regard, specifically around Apple. There's threats and stuff supposedly in the works. But right now, a lot of the government body regulation on Apple has come from the European Union. So make of that what you will. We are sponsored this week by SetApp. Are you tired of the never-ending search for the perfect app for your Mac or iOS device? SetApp for MacPaw is the perfect solution. It's the first subscription-based platform offering over 240 carefully curated apps for Mac and iOS devices. SetApp e-gift cards also make the perfect gift for the Mac user in your life, with flexible online delivery, even if you're buying at the last minute. This holiday season, give the gift of SetApp, the perfect fit for anyone with a Mac or iOS device. Hit the link in the show notes to learn more. Matt Corey asks, as an Apple media outlet with a great audience, what's your advice for an app developer to get press coverage in 2023 or 2024? How often should we reach out, and what should the message be, and what kind of media assets or other materials can we provide to make it easier on you? I was on Charlie Chapman's Launched podcast a few months ago, where I talked about this quite a bit, because Launched is usually he interviews, like, indie developers about their apps, and he had me on kind of to talk about the 9-to-5 Mac story a bit. But what I said on that show was, the more information you can give us about your app, and the more imagery and the more press, just material and details that you can give us, the better. And the more heads up you can give us, the better, about when your app's launching, what's new, and sort of your history, what other apps have you done, the big picture context too. And I think, don't get discouraged maybe if we don't write about, like, version one of your app, but we notice that you're pushing, like, every time you release an update, you're pitching us again and again. And we notice that, like, hey, this person's, like, making a great app and it's getting better at a very quick pace. That will catch our eye more than maybe a one-off email about the new launch of a new app.
Yeah, I would not be scared to send multiple emails. Like, the people that, I think some people might be like, oh, I don't want to, like, annoy them too much by sending messages. But the reality is, 9to5 Mac or any big websites get so many emails that you have to send something multiple times to have a chance of it being seen. Because there's just hundreds of emails, of tip emails about random apps coming in every week. Like, it's unbelievable the amount of stuff that comes in. And so if you're an app developer really trying to break through, I would send an email on every update that adds any feature of any significance, right? Like, you want to, if you're literally a nobody, that's the best way to do it. Release an app, screenshots, link, test flight invite.
Test flight,
in
yeah.
In the email, right? Release notes, photos. Give it a photo that can be used immediately for the header image, like, you know, 2x1, 16x9. Make it as easy as possible for somebody, whether it's 9 for Mac or any other website, to just get a post up about it, and you're way more likely to get it. If you send an email that's like, hey there, I've just made a new app and I'd like you to try it out. Please get back to me. Thank you. Bye. No one's going to reply to you. It's just... It's just a fact of labor, right? Like, yeah. There's so, like, it just, the time requirement is too much. What you need is, like, a simple title that says what's going on, screenshot, 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 release notes, test flight invite, and a link, and maybe the time at which the thing's coming out, and then thank you, bye. And obviously, if the website replies to you, you can follow up with more information. And just send that every single time there's an app update, and you might get lucky. You do always have to remember, though, that websites, even on a website like NFF Mac, we don't cover every app that ever exists on the App Store, right? There's like huge categories of applications that will never get coverage on 9to5 Mac. Just because you're in the App Store doesn't mean you're relevant to the website. I make my own apps, right? Bingo Machine, there's an app that generates bingo numbers for playing a game in, like, with family or friends or whatever. 9to5 Mac has no interest in covering Bingo Machine app updates, right? Like, yeah. I could send a Bingo Machine email to 9to5 Mac every day of the year. No one would ever care, and they should never post it because it doesn't make any sense. You've got to be relevant to the website. And when I was, not connected to news outlets or anything, I would, if I had an app that was more targeted towards the media that I was interested in, like the journalists that I knew or people that were online, then you can more like isolately target them, like at them on Twitter. When I was originally doing this, I would just like generate promo codes in the App Store and just add them to people. So like I make a promo code, and then on Twitter, I this is when I had less than 500 followers, right? I wasn't like a big name or anything. I would just say, I've made this app that does this. Please try it out. Here's a promo code. And you know what? I probably sent about 100 promo codes, and maybe 5 of them led to any conversion at all in terms of press attention. But the promo codes didn't really cost me anything. Nowadays, that tactic doesn't work very well because there are bots that just scrape social media for promo codes. So they never actually work. But even if you get the bot, even if you get a bot steal your promo code, if the person that you've sent it to is like interested in it, they might then reply being like, hey, this promo code doesn't work. Can you give me another one? So like you just kind of have to be very upfront and direct. And then a lot of luck involved as well. Because the simple matter is, if you're a tech website, if you're any website covering apps, you're getting so many emails and pitches every single day that don't be disheartened if you never get anyone reply to you. Just send another email in a month's time. That's your best chance.
I also think from our end, it's helpful or more incentivizing if in your initial email, maybe you include 5 or 6 promo codes that we can pass along to readers.
Mm-hmm.
That always incentivizes us to cover it more. And in the post, if somebody goes to redeem the promo code and it's expired, they might just go ahead and check out the app on their own accord because they thought it was interesting.
Yeah. And if it's an app, which is more common than ever these days, where like it doesn't really do anything until you've like made an account and used it for a while. Like, so it's something that I couldn't just download from the App Store and then test out in 5 minutes and work out if it's good or not.
Mm-hmm.
You really need to include like a video of like, this is like a screen recording of the app after it's been set up for a time. So for instance, a fitness app, right? Of course, you can still give a link to the App Store and a test flight and stuff. But practically speaking, I need to be able to filter my email in minutes, not days, right? So if someone sends me a pitch for like a cool new fitness tracking app, you kind of need to show me what it's like after a month of using it, right? No, because I'm not going to be able to use every single fitness app that comes to my email and then find out if it's good or not, right? I want to post to the website good stuff and I have to filter out rubbish. And if I can't work out if your thing's good or bad, it's just not going to get to the good pile. So think about it from that perspective as well. Like, yeah, you might be sending someone a promo code, but if you install the app and then it requires work for a long time to actually do anything, maybe try and think of a different way to do it. I know some developers like make accounts that are like demo accounts that are just pre-filled and pre-set up with information. And so in their pitch emails, they're like, okay, here's the link. And you can obviously make your own account and play about with it. But if you just want to get a sense of what's going on, enter, abc@g.com and the password's test. And then you can see a test account and get the hang of what's going on here. Make onboarding as easy as possible for press, just as you try and make onboarding as easy as possible for actual customers.
We are also sponsored this week by 1Password. The holiday shopping season is in full swing, but it marks the time when scammers and cyber criminals aim to exploit the heightened activity. This year, stay safe with some essential tips brought to you by 1Password. 1Password lets you safely store payment info, autofill securely with one click, and maintain a unique password for every site. The app's Watchtower feature identifies and updates your weak passwords. 1Password Families lets you share passwords securely in a vault for streaming services and Wi-Fi routers. And while traveling, you can use the Travel Mode feature inside 1Password to store crucial information for added security. For 9to5 Mac readers, save 40% on a yearly subscription with a 1Password individual account at the link in the show notes below. That's 40% off for 9to5 Mac fans at the link in the show notes below. Heidi Coley asks, what is your opinion on the studio display? Could or should Apple create a cheaper display? The studio display, I think, is a fantastic product, and it's just priced too high. Yep. I don't think the solution for Apple is to make a cheaper version of the studio display, but rather just lower the price of the current studio display, then maybe slot in a more expensive model somewhere in between it and the Pro Display XDR.
Yeah, I think the studio display is good, but ultimately what you're getting is a panel from 8 years ago that appeared in the 5K or IMAX, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's basically identical apart from it's slightly brighter. These days, I feel, yeah, you need 120Hz refresh rate or mini LED backlighting, so you get the contrast zones, the dimming zones. The studio display has neither of those things. And so I think for the price they charge for it, it's too expensive. It should probably be $1,000, $999, which is still expensive in the world of displays, right? But for an Apple display, that's more where it should line up. I think the $1,600 price is a bit, is asking too much. And then if you want design-wise comment, I think the bezels are too big.
Yeah,
I don't understand why the bezels in the studio display are that big.
They're bigger than the XDR.
Yeah, why? What I want is Apple to make like a, take the laptops, right? The MacBook Pro.
Mm-hmm.
Look how thin the bezels are on that thing. And it supports ProMotion, and it's got mini LED backlight behind it. It's a thin and small thing. Just make that 27 inches and sell that. If that was $16.99, I'd be way more up on the studio display because it'd be way more attractive and support higher refresh rate and everything. So yeah, that's what I'm kind of hoping they go for, a next generation external display. But I mean, as it stands right now, even the Pro Display XDR doesn't support like high refresh rate or anything. So Apple's commitment to the display market is
lacking,
fleeting, yeah. Right? Like, they'll do one update, then they'll leave it for 5 years before they do something else. So it was good that they started offering a studio display in 21? Was it 21, 22? One of the two.
I don't remember.
Yeah. But I wasn't particularly swayed by it. So I don't have one.